us. The Republicans, the President, the Democrats, they all have a piece of the blame.
Our country's going through a challenging time for sure.
The swamp.
The Republican president is at war with his own party. And the party is at war with itself.
There's not a complete consensus on how best to do health care reform. On tax reform, we have that consensus.
Boy, oh boy. They've been working on that one for 7 years. Can you believe that?
Democrats gave us Obamacare, and as it collapses, they're happy.
I know it was a late night last night, but a victorious one for the American people.
They like to knife them and cut them and let them die slowly.
Some in Congress want to have a bipartisan fix. Not clear whether that's possible.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, it has been a negative week for stocks this week, a losing week across the board with the exception of the Dow. We had some big events this week. One of them was Amazon missed their earnings by a wide margin. But for a fleeting brief moment of time, Jeff Bezos was the richest man in the world with a net worth of almost $92 billion. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up in Hour 1, Jonathan Krinsky will be joining me from MKM Partners. Jonathan sees this bull market intact and stock prices heading higher. There's nothing on the horizon right now to cloud that vision of higher prices. He'll be joining me in Hour 1, along with Robert Rapier, as we take a look at energy and the divorcing from reality between prices of energy and what's going on in the industry itself. He'll have a lot to say about that. Ryan Poplava will be here to talk about what moved the markets this week. Many things happening this week that pushed many of the indexes into negative territories.
And I'm John Loeffler. You know, history is replete with samples of manias and financial bubbles. There was the South Sea bubble. Everybody remembers the tulip bubble a couple of centuries ago, the recent tech bubble in the 90s, and then the real estate and mortgage bubble, which brought us to the disaster of 2007-2008. They all have the same anatomy. They go through the very same stages and the very same phases, and they happen in such a way that you wonder why people don't learn from history, but people don't seem to learn from it. And there's another bubble forming. So today on the Financial Sense News Hour during the big picture, what we're going to do is to look at the anatomy of a bubble. And the reason? Well, there's another one coming. So we don't want you to get clipped by it when it does come. All of that today on the Financial Sense News Hour. And first we go to Ryan Poplava, and so welcome back again this week for the wrap-up report. You know, in less than 15 minutes, we'll be highlighting the catalysts and drivers that move the U.S. financial markets this week. So, as we always like to do, tell us what the key events were this week that are really lying deeply on your mind.
Very deeply. I'm doing some mantras right now. Earnings.
That doesn't make a very good mantra, you realize. It's supposed to be like a monosyllabic word.
One word,
right?
Yeah, they were the key ones this week. Most important event this week was slightly more than, 200 something plus companies reporting this week. So after that, there was a few other key events, namely the FOMC met this week and gave its policy statement. OPEC and non-OPEC members met in Russia to kind of discuss compliance with its production cuts and kind of directive there. Trying to rein in, it looks like Nigeria's production in Libya, we've talked a lot about that on the oil side of things, where their production has really defeated all the cuts that they've been doing on top of U.S.'s production as well. On the economic side, it was the preliminary second quarter GDP figure released on Friday that was the important one. And finally, the rumor and news just late in the week that Jeff Gundlach bought five-month S&P 500 put options, he said was based on the expectation that volatility has been planning to increase, he believes, over that period that he bought, 5 months. Not a bad bet, John, considering, you look at the volatility index, it's otherwise known as the VIX, reached a 52-week low this week. So he said he was out of the money on the trade initially. This was in the Reuters report, but he says not anymore, as the very same volatility index had just a boost at the end of the week, probably as a result, a lot of other traders may be thinking the same thing. But he also talked about gold, saying that it's essentially, technically, it's above moving averages. It's coiling, as he termed it, and it's at a very key juncture. And yeah, gold you know, trades typically negatively correlated to the dollar. Dollar's been weak all year long. But other technicians I've seen recently, and some of my own work, I was looking at it early this week with Chris, my brother, and we were talking about, you know, looking at some of the demand zones on the dollar, saying it's had quite a bit of a move down. It, depending on some of the catalysts, and maybe technically it might be a time for that to kind of shore up a little bit, but, you know, that's neither here nor there.
So, Ryan, if the key catalyst this week were earnings and some other events surrounding that, what did earnings do to help the market?
Well, what did it do to help the market? It didn't hurt it. You know, if we look at how the market traded this week, there was a lot of positive earnings momentum. Market didn't really have a lot of momentum based on earnings. It just didn't sell off. So to me, that is suggesting, you know, there might be some concerns over valuations, and we can talk about that later. But back to your question, if you recall last week, I mentioned that earnings were projected to grow at 6.6% at the start of the earnings season. But after the great results we continue to see overall from blue chips, some of the financials, the industrials are really leading in that area. Estimates have gone up. Expectations right now are at 9% growth in earnings year over year. Going back to the beginning of this year, we based a lot of the growth in the market based on earnings. The turnaround that we saw based on the third quarter last year, I focused on it a lot right before Trump was elected. We talked about that. We talked about the uncertainty in the elections, really the only thing that was holding back the market. Again, that resolved, and then the markets took off. But that trend continues, John, and it continues to get better. You know, looking at the earnings trend for the S&P 500, potentially, this could extend the bull market even further than our original projections. Gosh, back in early 2016, we feared the onset of a recession. We were looking at economics that were rolling over. The leading economic indicators were rolling over. Growth was rolling over and negative. But that's changed. So, you know, for example, last year, about this time, we were hovering around 128 earnings per share in the S&P 500. I talked about a lot because we talked about PE ratios back then and earnings growth or the lack thereof. It's now since gone up to, we're now looking at the third quarter and we're now at earnings expectations of around 140. So that has fueled the S&P's valuation, the growth of it, the momentum. The other driver we highlighted in the first quarter this year that we talked a lot about, because it was really all there was really to talk about, was the potential for fiscal stimulus based on a lot of the areas that Trump and the Republicans were bringing to the table and were talking about. But unfortunately, that's really all it's been. It's just been a lot of talk. There hasn't been a whole lot of action. There was a lot of, you know, you look at politically what happened this week in the healthcare side of things, the vote to basically say, we're going to continue to look at it. That's essentially all that passed. And it took a tie to get that from the vice president. So no real progress, unfortunately, there. But that's a great sign to see that the market has done really well, done it based on earnings and growth and the lack thereof currently of all that fiscal stimulus that has the potential to grow earnings even more. But, you know, the fact that we continue to just get close to zero progress on these items in Washington, yet the S&P is trading at record levels, shows that the primary driver, like I said, is its earnings growth, and you could also say a friendly Fed.
Okay, if we had to look at the earnings season, is there something other than earnings have grown that you think is really significant?
You know, it's not just cost cutting or share buybacks, which was the case for many years, or what I basically call engineered growth, right? That's what companies can do directly to try and affect their earnings growth. The one thing they can't affect, except for through marketing or more directly, is revenue growth. And we are seeing that. So we're getting that quality shift from low quality, cost cutting, buybacks of shares. And now there's just this genuine increase in revenues, which is what I call high quality. So it's definitely shifted, John, from a low quality earnings season. It's now high quality. And according to FactSet, just to give you some facts here from FactSet, there's an equal percent of companies that are beating on earnings as revenues. And that's around 73%. So 73% of companies reporting are beating on earnings and revenues. I can remember when it was a high percentage on earnings and it was like 50-50 on revenues. So that's just great progress. Last year at this time, revenue growth for the S&P 500, 0.2%. Right now, 5.2. So it's been great. Good quality earnings, good earnings. And, you know, that's statistics. That's hard data. Tech stocks have had a harder time recently. This has been an area where all the performance has been. And looking at some of the earnings reports, there was Amazon and Seagate this week that had negative responses to earnings or disappointed. Amazon really only falling 2.5% on Friday. Not a huge chunk there. The real winners on the flip side have been industrials and financials, which have had great upside surprises. Boeing had great results, and the reaction to their stock price was good as well. Looking at the durable goods report, so one of the other important economic reports besides the GDP report was the durable goods, and it surged like 6.5% in June, mainly due to transportation equipment, a 19% increase there, and then non-defense aircraft up 131%. So, you know, that coupled with Boeing having great earnings really helped that area. And then our transports, when you factor out transport, durable goods only at 0.2%. So that wasn't as great. So the good economic and earnings reports definitely were there for Boeing. The other earnings report that I found welcomed was Ford's, which beat and raised guidance. However, there's been a lack of revenue growth there. Mind you, you know, I've been looking at the auto industry very closely. Chris Sheridan's talked about it on Insider with some credit report views with some experts there. So it's definitely been an area of the economy that is of concern with rising interest rates. They're not doing the kind of sales that we're doing before because they're cutting back on who they're allowing credit to. Those subprime type lenders is definitely in decline. McDonald's was up nicely on a beaten increase of around 6.6% in global sales growth. So good quality there. In tech, Facebook did well, and I think I was just about coming in here and I saw that Intel had done well. Overall earnings, just a great week.
Well, let me ask you a question then. Are there any concerns that the market just might be ahead of itself given Gundlach made that hedging bet this week?
That's a very good question. And like I said, it's on the concern of many. The fact that we had a great earnings week and the S&P didn't do too much, I think speaks volumes. If anything, holding back the S&P 500 right now or the NASDAQ, I'm hearing from trading desks, is that very concern, its valuations. And technically, you know, we've had a very good run since November. And despite that little consolidation we had in March, the S&P continues to be trending nicely higher. Yes, the market is overvalued. What is the number? The PE of 17.7, looking at forward earnings. And that's above the five-year average, which is around 15.4. But like I said, the earnings trend is up. We're up at 140 versus 128 a year ago, and that trend continues to move up. So I'm not too worried about that right now. But Gundlach, I would say he made a very calculated investment. Hedging here, given the cost of hedging, is low. You look at options, what are the factors that go into the valuation of an option? It's volatility. It's the time value of money and how much an option is in the money or out the money. And you look at volatility being at a 52-week low. He bought these things cheap. So very smart. But from a monetary perspective, we got the FOMC meeting this week. They continue to be friendly towards the market. So if the FOMC is being friendly and we have earnings growth, you know, I don't think we see the onset of a recession around the corner right now. I know Chris in all of his reviews, I think he did an interview this week with Chris Sheridan this week. I highly encourage anybody that is a subscriber to check in on that. That will really tell you what we're looking at, what are our indicators saying, and what are we following. So I would suggest tuning in there if you want to learn more about what our feeling is on the market. But like I said, a friendly Fed, earnings growth, things look great for the market right now. Yes, we could technically see a consolidation seasonally. We typically do. Seasonally, we tend to have some weak Septembers and weak October heading up towards the strong season, which is the first quarter typically. So anyways, is there a concern over valuations? Yes. And did Gundlach make a very calculated and educated move? Highly agree. He did.
Well, we know that blue chip industrial stocks are an area to keep your eye on. Anything else that you think is important?
Just as I mentioned, the OPEC meeting was this week. You know, I think you want to keep a close eye on energy. Any investor listening right now, keep a close eye on it. It's an area that's been underperforming all year long. I know some people have tried jumping in early. Technically, things are improving there, and they're no longer in a downtrend. They've been in since the beginning of the year. OPEC is moving to try and get, like I said, Nigeria and Libya to join their production cuts, or at least hold at their specific rates. And I think I read something about Nigeria agreeing to some production rates. And as I've been mentioning these past few weeks, there's been, if you look at the American petroleum inventory levels that they've been announcing weekly, there's been a draw almost every single week. And that's been influencing oil, which is now up, gosh, 8.3% this week alone. So definitely look at that area, follow it. And the other area that was very interesting this week was the transports. The transport index fell significantly this week, kind of diverging from the industrials. And it's all earnings related, but I also think it has to do with, hey, gosh, oil's up 8% this week. That might be part of it as well, because typically transports and energy move in opposite directions, because, you know, that's the cost of moving goods is energy. Check out those areas. Definitely some interesting things developing there. I'd say definitely a bottom is forming, and I've been talking about it and highlighting it for weeks now. So definitely an area that we're watching. So listeners should do as well.
Much moving on the boards, I guess I would say. It's been become real interesting. Of course, I always seem to end with that every week, but it is interesting. You know, sometimes things are downright boring. Other times they're just downright exciting. So I appreciate it, Ryan Poplava. We'll see you again next week.
There will always be something new to talk about every week. I promise you that.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense News Hour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
Elliott identified that markets are not driven in the bigger perspective predominantly by news. News can act as catalysts for a specific move on the smaller degree, but over the longer term trend, markets are generally driven by market sentiment, and markets are generally patterned through how they move over time. As an example, back in 1941, when World War II was raging about, Elliott predicted that we're going to have a massive 70-plus year market rally. And when you consider you're in the middle of World War II when he predicted such a move, I mean, it's one of the best market calls, I mean, I've ever read about. So he identified that markets move in patterns based upon market sentiment, human psychology, and so on and so forth. We utilize Fibonacci mathematics to be able to identify the turning points as to where those turns can occur in the market, specifically because Fibonacci mathematics is based upon the natural law, which governs all natural things in the world. And human beings and psychology of human beings are clearly part of the natural world. So we see the human thought in mass turns on those Fibonacci mathematic calculations. But we look for a confluence of calculations to be able to identify where those turns will occur.
Well, the news is pretty much the same. Every single week, stocks go up, they hit a new record. And that's the story and the way it's been for all of 2017. Joining us on the program from MKM Partners is Jonathan Krinsky. Jonathan, let's begin with the stock averages here in the U.S. on the day you and I are speaking this Thursday. Markets are at all-time records, which seems to be the story.
Yeah, Jim, as you said, there hasn't been much change here. We haven't seen really much of a pullback at all. And as a result, we have volatility at pretty much all-time or historic lows. So, you know, the questions we continue to get is how long can it last? You know, I think the first thing to recognize is that low volatility is a hallmark of strong uptrends. If you go back to the early to mid-90s, and then even before that, prior to actually the VIX coming out, if you go back to some of the mid-1950s and 1960s, there's periods of very low volatility, and we can look at other metrics for that, but also coincided with pretty strong bull markets. So, you know, I think ultimately, if we're talking about what will end this, you'll start to see volatility actually pick up as the markets move higher. And that's, of course, what we saw in the late 90s at the end of the tech bubble run. You actually saw volatility rising with a rising market. So we haven't seen that yet. And then I think also a key point to highlight, just this week, we had the S&P 500 technology sector finally, after 17 years, exceed its March 2000 closing high. So you have a 17-year breakout in the tech sector, which joins a lot of the major indices that have done that in the last few years, obviously the S&P, Dow, NASDAQ, composite. So big picture, still think things are okay. You know, if we're talking about a little bit of a shorter time frame, you know, maybe we're getting a little overheated and due for a bit of a consolidation phase.
You know, one of the things that we have not seen this year that we've seen in previous years, Jonathan, I'd like to hear your thoughts on this. We haven't even had so much as a 5% correction this year.
Yeah, it's really remarkable. And again, that is reflected in a VIX that's essentially at all-time historic lows. So nothing surprising there. I think what's driving this has been the constant internal sector rotation that is really just keeping things in a very narrow range. So we know that technology has been the leader this year, but even when it had its biggest pullback of the year following the mid-June, we had some kind of negative outside days in the tech sector in mid-June, and technology took a pause there. But as that happened, you saw some other areas of the market pick up the slack. So you had financials doing a little bit better, biotech. You know, healthcare is kind of surprisingly one of the best sectors of the year. On an equal weight basis, it's actually the best sector of the year. So it's been these constant internal rotations that have kept the overall market at bay. And, you know, I don't know how long that'll last, but as long as it does, it's difficult for the overall market to see a meaningful pullback.
So when you see strong uptrends like this, is this also being shown with the inflows? I know, for example, that we're seeing these FANG stocks. On the day you and I are speaking, Amazon just hit another record, making Jeff Bezos now the richest man in the world, actually beating out Bill Gates. But as money comes into these index funds and they have to push that money through into these large cap stocks that make up the indexes, are you seeing this reflected in money flows that's driving this? Because somebody's buying stocks, the money's coming from somewhere.
Yeah, I'm sure that's the case. We actually haven't found that inflows or outflows are a very reliable tool, because our work is better spent on what's actually happening as opposed to why it's happening. So we prefer to look at breadth measures, because even though ETFs have become a bigger part of our market over the last few years, we still see that oftentimes breadth will start to deteriorate before the overall index will deteriorate. So the most memorable pullback in the last couple of years was in the summer of 2015. And if you go back to that period of time, there was massive divergences in breadth. So the percentage of stocks above the 200-day moving average had been rolling over since probably May of 2015. And so it took a couple months of divergence before the indices finally cracked in August. And we just haven't seen that yet. So breadth remains good. The trend remains good. I'm sure flows are helping, but unless and until we see signs of more significant divergences, it's tough to get too cautious, again, for the medium-term picture. Short-term, there's always the chance that we could be at or near a short-term inflection point. But, you know, bigger picture, breadth is really our key driver here.
Yeah, you know, when you look at something like this, when you see the advanced decline line, the number of stocks that are above their 200-day moving averages and 50-day moving averages, are these the kind of things, Jonathan, you like to see when you see these strong uptrends?
Yeah, that's it. I mean, the cap-weighted indices in particular are certainly being driven by some of the FANG names because they're such a big part of the market. But another thing to look at is something like the equal weight tech sector versus the cap weight tech sector. And that is actually almost at a new multi-year high. So that tells you that, yes, the big cap stocks are doing a lot of lifting, but there's a lot of participation below the surface as well. Now, in the last week or two, there have been a couple small things worth highlighting. The transports, for instance, have been down, I think, 8 of the last 9 days. So that may be something to keep an eye on. But overall, again, breadth is too strong at this point to look for any type of major inflection point.
Let's talk about something outside the U.S., and that is the international markets. Whether you're looking at the international markets or the emerging markets, we've seen some very, very strong uptrends and breakouts after virtually going nowhere for years. So let's talk about the international markets, which seem to be doing rather well this year.
They have been, and that's been a trade that has been on a lot of people's radar for the last couple of years, and this year it looks like it may finally play out, at least so far. But, you know, I think if you look particularly in some Asian markets, Taiwan and South Korea are breaking out of massive 10, 15, even 20-year bases over there. Europe had a good start. It's rolling over a little bit. I think some of that is due to this fact that the euro had a very strong 5 or 6% rally in the last few weeks, but there's some good things happening in Europe. So yeah, I think, you know, the global breadth story is as important as the U.S. breadth story. So if we're talking about looking for a major top sign in the U.S., I think you would have to also see some more weakness in the global picture, and we're just not seeing that yet.
Does it strike you as rather odd, Jonathan, that we are seeing the Fed move gradually, albeit, in raising interest rates? They're talking about shrinking their balance sheet. We now have the ECB talking about maybe ending or starting with the taper, their bond buying. So we're starting to see central banks move in the opposite direction, which recently brought Ray Dalio of Bridgeport to say, well, keep dancing on the dance floor, but you know, move closer to the exit. Does that concern you in any way that this tremendous amount of liquidity, I think I read that it's something like $15 trillion that central banks have brought into the market, that they are now starting to think about removing some of that liquidity. But right now, we've got them moving in that direction and stock markets all around the globe breaking out.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, we have to remember that stocks are some of the best leading indicators out there. And it would be very unusual for stocks to not sniff out whether that's going to be a problem or not. So at some point, it probably will be a problem, but I would imagine that equities in general would, you know, begin to deteriorate ahead of that. So it's telling you two things. Either one, it's not happening anytime soon, or two, it's not as big of an issue for the market. And, you know, I think there could be a time, whether it's 6 or 12 months from now or 2 years from now, that the balance sheets will start shrinking. And then maybe at that point, stocks will notice. But at this point, they're not showing any signs that that's going to be an issue for the market.
Well, it's amazing because if you look at where the Fed funds rate is at 1.25 in 2004, when the Fed began to raise interest rates, the Fed funds rate, they started at 1%. So we're just basically a quarter of a point from where we started in 2004. And speaking of interest rates, let's talk about what's going on in the bond market. We've had 10-year treasuries at the beginning of the year with the Fed getting a little bit more aggressive in terms of the rate hikes, the number of them, and then talking about shrinking their balance sheet. It was thought that we would be somewhere between 2.5% and 3%. Instead, we've been between 2.1% and 2.4% for most of the year. What's your take on 10-year treasuries here?
Yeah, so I think that's another trade that a lot of people want to be on. They want to call the bottom in interest rates. It's been a 35-year bear market for interest rates. And if we think about the last time we transitioned from a secular bear market in rates to a secular bull, that was in the 1940s and 50s. And it really took 10 or 15 years before rates started trending higher in a meaningful way. So our thought is that 10-year yields have seen their secular low down at, I think it was 130 or 135, but that doesn't mean we have to be on a straight path to 3.5% or 4%. So it's going to take time to transition from this 35-year bull market in bonds to a bear market in bonds. And, you know, I think what we're seeing now is just part of that process. There's a couple signs that are encouraging if you're looking for higher rates. German 10-year yields hit a multi-year high a few weeks ago. And even though rates haven't been going up, they've been kind of holding this 220, 225 level. So the setup is there. We just need to see a bit more evidence. You know, ultimately, I think if you take out 265 on the 10-year, which seems like quite a long way away at this point, but that was kind of the double top resistance earlier this year. If you were to take that out at this point, I think you could have a more meaningful case that rates are going to be trending higher for a sustained period of time. But right now, I think it's just a bit early to make that call.
Yeah, and the other thing, too, is if you take a look at treasuries, which are close to 2.3%, doesn't sound like much until you look at what rates are over in Europe, where, you know, you have Italian bonds that are less than U.S. bonds and German bonds that are, what, 0.5%. So, you know, U.S. treasuries almost look like junk bonds when you compare them to yields in Europe.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's been one of the cases that's been made for the last couple of years of why U.S. rates have been held back. Is just it's a relative value trade to the rest of the globe. So that certainly makes some sense. But again, if we see some of the German bonds, if we start to see those yields break out, then that would also enhance the case for higher U.S. yields.
Let's talk about another sector that has been struggling this year with the exception of ag commodities, and that's been oil. Gold and silver are up slightly for the year, but certainly you would have expected them to be up more given what's happened to the dollar. So let's talk about commodities, beginning with oil.
Yeah, so oil, our call is really, there's no trend in WTI. It's really been neutral for quite a while now, and again, that's consistent with what happened in 2014. You saw 70-80% bear market, and that takes a long time to heal. So we're call it 2 years in off of that bear market. So we think we could be in this 45 to 55 range for a good while longer. And, you know, that's not a very surprising call, perhaps, but that's really how we see it. As far as the energy stocks, it's been a tough trade. There are some encouraging signs for the case to be made that energy is, it's time to maybe look at that and rotate in as a lagging sector. And a couple of the things we've been highlighting is the breakout in some of the commodity currencies. So currencies like the Australian dollar, the New Zealand kiwi, Canadian dollar, Norwegian krona, some of those currencies have really been breaking out of late. And that oftentimes can be a leading indicator for the commodity and energy trade in particular. So that's certainly interesting. We'd also highlight the solar stocks, which have kind of been forgotten, have been coming out of a nice base. So all of these suggest that maybe there's a turn in energy, but again, we probably need to see a bit more evidence, some more trend lines broken, some higher highs in the energy stocks. So right now, we're dipping a toe in there, but could still see some more evidence. As far as the other commodities, as you mentioned, gold and silver, we think they're still a bit vulnerable on the downside. They've been kind of range-bound here, but as you mentioned, they haven't been able to do much despite the fact that the dollar's down significantly in the last couple months. So we think if the dollar moves higher and if interest rates move higher, then gold could be a bit vulnerable on the downside. But again, it's been kind of frustrating to bulls and bears for the last few months.
So when you see things like this, trend in place, what's the saying, tends to be remain a trend in place until it's replaced with something else. So right now, as we look at the major averages, they continue to break out, new records set every single week. We also have the leadership and technology and healthcare. A lot of the same sectors that have done well all year continue to do so. Would you expect any change? In other words, at some point, do people say, hey, this has had one heck of a run. I'm going to take some profits off the table when you think of some of the FANG stocks. And maybe I'm going to rotate in something that hasn't done as well as you just mentioned, energy.
Yeah, that's certainly a possibility. The issue for the market is that energy is such a small weighting in the market that if we were to, let's say, see a rotation out of tech and healthcare, and it only went into energy and maybe some materials, that wouldn't be enough to hold the market up. But if you see the rotation into the other big value sector, which is financials, then that would certainly probably be okay for the overall market. The one other sector that I think we're starting to see a couple signs of cracking is in the industrials. It's been one of the best sectors for a long time, but I mentioned the transports are part of that, and they've been rolling over a bit now. So, you know, we'd keep an eye on the industrials to see if that is maybe anything to worry about. But again, yeah, the constant rotation continues to be a theme this year, and as long as the money's going somewhere within equities, then that's going to keep the uptrends intact. So we'll stick with that game plan for now.
So, Jonathan, I guess the one question that always comes up as we look at the markets every single week, a trend that's in place every single week, we get new records for major indexes, and it's global this time. It's not just the U.S. We're seeing a breakout, as you mentioned, in Asia, South Korea, Taiwan, Singapore, and places like that. If trouble was to erupt somewhere, or if there was something that was to give you caution, when you see these new kind of records, like, you know, you think back what happened between 1998 as stocks were just going through the roof, and that trend actually lasted for several years. If there was trouble to erupt, how would you see that taking place, and where's the more likely suspects?
Yeah, so again, I think you would be looking for breadth to deteriorate, and we just haven't seen breadth deteriorating for more than a couple weeks throughout most of this run in the last couple of years. So you're going to see some of the secondary stocks start to roll over. And then again, I think you'd expect volatility to expand. You know, VIX printing 52-week lows is very easy to say, well, that's contrarian. The market must be at a top. But you know, it usually doesn't work that way. You usually see volatility expanding with price. You know, as far as some other areas that could be early tells, we mentioned the German DAX is down 5 or 6% from the highs. Again, I think part of that is due to the euro strength, but if that weakness were to persist, even as the euro maybe weakens a little bit, that would be an area of concern. And then we're also keeping an eye on the credit markets. And as many know, credit markets tend to be often a good leading indicator. And we're just not seeing any signs of stress in really any forms of the credit market. Even as energy has been relatively weak, energy credit has been holding firm and investment grade credit has been holding firm. So there's a lot of different areas to look for potential signs of cracks. But, you know, at this point, it's maybe just a couple small pockets here and there, but nothing too concerning at this point.
So I guess in summary, Jonathan, you expect this trend to continue. Low volatility, breadth is strong, markets continue to go up. Stay with that trend until something changes.
Yeah, I think that's the right call. You know, certainly with volatility so low, we wouldn't prohibit anybody from buying maybe some protection for one of those shocks that you mentioned that maybe cannot be seen, even despite the fact that breadth is good. But yeah, I mean, I think it's still premature to try to fight the trend. Even if this is sort of the end of this run, there's usually a retest after you get that initial pullback, right? So I don't think, you know, trying to pick the exact top is necessarily a wise move at this point. But yeah, we would stick with it. There's still a lot of good trends out there, a lot of good breakouts still working. And, you know, until that stops working, we would stick with it.
Listen, Jonathan, as we close, if our listeners like to follow your work, tell them how they could do so, please.
Yeah, the best way is to be on Twitter, at JKrinsky MKM.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
If you're approaching retirement age or concerned about making plans for those retired years and having adequate income, you're going to want to hear our Lifetime Income series every Monday and Tuesday here at financialsense.com. Right now, here's a preview of this week's Lifetime Income program.
Joining me on the program is Chris Hennessy. He's professor of law at Babson College and consultant to Putnam Investments. And Chris, last time we had you on the show talking about taxes right around April 15th, there were two kinds of plans that were being submitted. There were the president's plan on tax rates, and then there was the GOP plan. The tax brackets, I guess when we look at the tax brackets, there were 0, 12, 25, and 33 versus, let's say, the 35 and 39.6. Since then, there's been a couple ideas. One floated by the president this week that he might raise taxes for the upper income individuals. And it was suggested a tax rate of 42 to 44. I've heard a couple senators talk about a 35% tax rate. So let's talk about tax reform. Number one, do you think it's possible it'll get done this year because healthcare reform has gone nowhere?
Sure. I think there is a difference, Jim. Tax reform is a little bit different. The healthcare thing was highly complex because it interwove both Medicaid and so-called repeal of Obamacare. I think the difference is with tax reform, number one, on the corporate side, there's a fair amount of Democratic bipartisan support. And secondly, Republican side, these Republicans do not want to go back to their districts, whether they're in the Senate or the House, and say, okay, well, we campaigned, Trump campaigned, said we're going to get tax cuts, we didn't get it done, or I voted against it. So that would hurt them in midterm elections, which, of course, is a little more than a year away. So I think there is a difference. Now, to your point about you mentioning individual brackets, whether the scope of this will be as large as originally outlined, because remember, as originally outlined, you're talking about individual tax cuts, corporate tax cuts, repeal the estate and gift tax, repeal the alternative minimum tax. And the bracket question is simply driven by the mathematics of all this. I mean, there's a difference between tax cuts and tax reform. Trump talks about a $5 trillion tax cut. That's a reduction in revenue, reducing marginal rates, both the corporate side and the individual side. Tax reform is something the GOP, Paul Ryan, talks a lot about. That's tax simplification, Jim. So I think it will get done probably towards the end of the year. A very interesting question is, what would the effective date be? Will it be retroactive or prospective?
Well, after struggling for almost the last 3 or 4 months, we have oil prices back on the upsurge. We're approaching nearly $50 a barrel. But is this just a short-term bounce, or are inventories declining and eventually we're going to get to higher prices? Joining me on the program is Robert Rapier. Robert, let's begin with oil prices. A couple key things I'd like to hear your comments on. We had the OPEC production cuts, and that helped a rally in the first quarter of the year, but they overproduced in the fourth quarter. We have American shale up. We have Nigerian and Libyan production up, which is almost absorbing that. But yet, we do have inventories falling. And I want to talk about something recent. Saudi Arabia's decision to cut back their exports to the United States. What impact is that going to have on drawing down American inventory levels? Because the market keeps focusing on inventory and production.
Yeah, that's one of the odd things that I've observed, that even as inventory levels in the U.S. were high, we continue to import a lot of oil. And so Saudi restricting oil imports to the U.S. should help bring our inventories down faster. They are coming down. This is heavy refining season. All the refineries are up and running. We've passed maintenance season. And so you're seeing some real declines in U.S. inventories. And I think the Saudi move will help that continue. Because typically what you see a drawdown until about, maybe September, October, and then you have fall refinery season, and you'll see inventories start to build back up again. And this may slow that build, or it may even continue to allow inventories to decline. You've also got a flattening now of the rig count, seems to be kind of flattening out at the current oil price. And that is probably going to flatten out production some, and that will help bring inventories down.
Yeah, I wonder, speaking of inventories, because we know as we get into the fall months, there's less use, the summer driving season is over, and we have that shoulder month where the weather's nice outside, we're consuming less energy. The market seems fixated on American inventories, which seem to be more closely monitored than what we can do overseas. So as we head into the fall, the shoulder months, inventories might start to build again. Does that bring down the price of oil?
It might. It seems like all news is filtered through a bearish filter these days. You know, I've watched over the spring as inventories went down, 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 and it would be moderately supportive of prices. And then if you saw one surprise build, it would wipe out all the gains. And I've seen this again and again and again. And I think until oil really starts to make some sustained progress here of holding on to $50 or so, and the energy companies continue to report earnings that are beating expectations, I think people are going to have that overreaction that any sort of bearish news is going to overly punish the market to the downside.
You know, it reminds me of investor psychology, and you can see this today reflected in the stock market. After 9 years where the stock market has gone up in this economic recovery and bull market, now investors are flowing into index funds as easy money, like it's brainless investing. I don't have to think. It happens conversely on the bearish side when you had oil prices hit, 110 bucks, and what was it, 2014 when we were over 100, we've been seeing falling oil prices. Now you have that sentiment. It's almost like everything that happens in the oil market, as you mentioned, you have 1 week where inventories go up and it just wipes out all the gains in oil. It's the same psychology, but this time on the bearish side.
Yeah, I mean, you do have a lot of bearish money flooding in, and I can read some of the commentary from a Goldman Sachs or somebody, and you think, these guys have made a bearish bet here, and they're trying to push out the news that they think prices are going to continue to remain low. And I see that again and again. You see money flowing into the bearish side, and you see the commentary from a lot of these big brokerages that are trying to support, you know, the bearish case.
So that's the bearish case. So we're looking at oil because a couple things have happened here, and I want to hear your comments on this and your views. And that is, at one time, the figure used to be $65, $70 as break even on shale. Then it got down to $55, $50 to $60. Now I hear $40, and then some companies are talking about in the $30s. So with technology and experience, the cost of producing shale has come down, and I think that's even surprised OPEC that American producers were able to come back in and make some profit at lower oil prices. That trend continues. At what point does the market wake up and say that, and a good example of this is you have the big boys, the Exxons, the Chevrons, are now saying, look, we're going to scrap or put on hold these multi-billion dollar deep shore, very expensive long-term projects. We're going to move into shale in Texas, where the payback on shale is very quick and we can make a profit. So when does the market wake up to that reality? Because some of these companies, from Exxon to Chevron to a lot of the big boys, including Royal Dutch Shell, are making some good money here.
Yeah, and you know, ConocoPhillips did this a year or two ago. They said, we're done with our deep water. We're going to focus on onshore. A lot of these guys are doing that. OPEC clearly underestimated the cost savings that would come out of shale. I think when OPEC originally decided to declare a price war and try to win back market share from U.S. shale, they thought, and to take you back to mid-2014, as you mentioned earlier, the oil price was about $100 a share. By November, when OPEC met, the price had declined to about $75, and a lot of these shale producers were under pressure. And I think OPEC said, hey, if we dump a little more oil on the market, we're going to drive the price down to maybe $60, and we're going to put all these guys out of business. These guys will not be able to make a profit. And that was the you know, the standard belief that it would take 70, 80 or more. And in some cases, it did. There were some companies that were not in sweet spots of shale plays, and they were heavily leveraged, and they did need $80, $90, $100. And those companies, most of them went bankrupt. But, you know, as oil prices remained low, you had companies start to implement financial discipline. You had them start to demand better terms from their oil field services providers, from their midstream providers. And they were able to squeeze down, you know, cost to the point where probably at $50, a lot of these guys will be able to make a reasonable profit. And on some new wells, and I think Shell came out recently and said, on some of our new shale wells, we can make a profit in the 20s. Now, that's not an average across the company, and certainly not an average across the shale play, but it just shows that, you know, some of the break-even costs are quite low, and they're much lower than they were 5 years ago.
So I guess as we look going forward, we know that beginning in September and October, we're going into the shoulder months for energy where consumption is less. So we might start to see an energy build, which is maybe why the bears are pushing this story out. At least the stuff I read, they're saying, hey, look out, we're going to be back below 40, which I don't know if I buy below 40, it might dip. But Robert, if there was to be a catalyst that changes the psychology, because everything that happens, as you just mentioned, 1 week of inventory build, and I remember that, and it just shudders the markets and the price collapses. What kind of catalyst, if there is one out there, will take to turn this around?
Civil war in Venezuela. I mean, it's the Venezuela situation is really falling apart. And if they can't export their oil, they export a substantial amount of oil to the U.S. and to the world economy. That is a substantial source of oil. So that's one. Again, I think it would still take a little bit of time before people absorb and appreciate, wow, we just lost, you know, a couple, 3 million barrels a day off the world market, but it would start to show up in inventories and you'd see an acceleration in the decline of inventories. For something to be a fast response, I think you'd have to have OPEC and Saudi come out and say, we're going to make deeper cuts. And I think they probably have the capability of pushing oil prices up to $60. By the end of the year, if they came out and said, you know, we think the market is balancing, but it's not balancing fast enough, and we're going to make, you know, another 10% across the board cut, I think they get oil prices to $60 by the end of the year. But I really think it's going to take a sustained, clear observation that the inventories are coming down. Globally, they're still high, and you've always got that. You've always got that headwind there as long as those inventories are as high as they are. And the recent announcement that we're going to sell off part of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, that didn't help because that throws more oil into the market. And I have seen some of those sales have shown up. You've seen, you know, if you watch the Energy Information's weekly petroleum status report, they have shown that there have been some sales out of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. So that certainly doesn't help matters.
So what are the probabilities that they could do that? Because if OPEC was to cut, it would mainly have to come from Saudi Arabia, which would have motivations given their IPO of Aramco next year. What are the probabilities that they do that? Because it seems like if you take the 1.8 million barrels cut, if you take American shale up by almost 1 million, you take Nigeria and Libya, there's almost your 1.8, Robert. So the only thing that's drawing things down is increased demand.
That's right. But that's the piece that people always forget about, because they treat demand as sort of static, and it's not static. It's still, you know, for 35 years, it's gone up by more than a million barrels a day a year. And over the past few years, it's been, you know, 1.4, 1.5, 1.6 million barrels a day. So when you throw that piece into the equation, you see, all right, inventories definitely should be coming down. You know, I'm always trying to get in Saudi's head and to figure out, okay, what is it that I would do in this situation? And I second-guessed them in 2014 when they decided to declare a price war. I said, this is not going to end well for them, and it didn't. What I would have done instead, because they still control 40% of the world's oil production, I would have said, hey, we're going to take production offline. And then, yes, that would have helped the shale producers, but it would have also been supportive of prices. And then you've got to figure, at some point, the shale production is going to peak and start to decline. And so the argument that Saudi had to have been having is, all right, how many cuts do we have to make before shale production actually starts to decline? Because if shale production can expand by another 5 or 10 million barrels a day, then there's nothing Saudi can do. Their hands are tied. OPEC will ultimately lose. But if we're close to a peaking of shale production, then all OPEC would have had to have done is make a couple of cuts. I mean, they could have easily taken 10% of the world market offline. I mean, they could have done that. They have enough production that they could have done that. And, that, you know, that would have been hugely supportive of prices. I have no doubt they could have kept prices at $100. And then the, you know, the shale producers would have kept cranking out. But at some point, things are going to start to go downhill for them. And the only question is, what point is that? Is it a million, 2 million barrels a day from now? Is it more than five? And if it's more than five, then nothing OPEC is going to do is going to help.
So outside production cuts, about the only thing that is going to draw demand or draw these inventories down, because basically production is matching their cuts. If you take U.S. shale and Libya and Nigeria. So let's talk about something else nobody talks about, which is depletion. Because if you go to some of these older fields, you're running, 3-4% depletion a year. So you have two things that reduce oil. One is depletion and one is demand, which is increasing use. So if somebody in China starts driving a car, you now have a new oil consumer. So I guess the question is, how long does this really take to balance? Originally, they thought by the end of 2016, then they thought by 2017. Now I hear talks it's going to be 2018. In your estimate, when does it balance?
Yeah, I mean, it's been tough because I thought it would balance quicker than now as well. The one thing I didn't anticipate, I did expect shale production to start back up, but I didn't anticipate that it would be as strong as fast as it has been. And I think that's the thing that caught most people off guard. And the other was, you know, we didn't see a full 1.8 million cut from OPEC as promised. You know, a lot of these guys didn't cut. And so had we seen the full 1.8 million cut from the beginning, we would have seen things coming down a lot faster than now. Although, again, the bounce back in U.S. shale production would have sort of offset that some, but not certainly not all. So, you know, what it's going to take is discipline within OPEC, and it's going to take, you know, the rig count is going to have to continue. And we are reading that a lot of the oil companies are cutting back on their capital spending, on their drilling. I was in the Bakken last week. I saw a tremendous amount of drilling activity up there. Marathon was drilling all over the place, but I've heard that they're going to cut back their rigs up there. So I think a lot of these guys are like this. They're seeing, okay, we're not going to get to $60, $70 oil, which is maybe what we thought one or two quarters ago. And so we're going to cut back on our drilling. And so I think we'll see production once again start to flatten or even start to decline, as we did when the rig count plummeted in 2014.
Yeah, because we're starting to see that. I watched the weekly rig count. It is starting to fall. It's starting to flatten. Well, it started to flatten. Now it's starting to fall. And as you mentioned, and the Journal's been running a number of articles on the majors who are scrapping their big, large projects. They're moving into the shale basins where they can have a quick payback and it costs less money. And they're, quite honestly, there's less risk because the money you spend, you get immediate cash flow. So that's much better for the company's bottom line. Let's move to the energy investment area. Last year, with the OPEC cuts coming, the energy stocks were one of the top producers in the S&P. This year, if you look at the energy ETF, XLE, it's down about 12% for the year. Oil's down. And yet, recently, if you take a look at Q1 and Q2 profits, they're looking pretty good. The same pessimism that we see in the price of oil, the bearish bets, seems to be present when it comes to the energy stocks.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's going to take more. I think there's a disconnect here between perceptions and reality. And the reality is the energy companies have been faring okay, and they've been beating expectations. The expectation is that we've got electric cars coming, and we've got, you know, we're oil is at the end, and we're at the end of the oil age, and you know, these high inventories, and there's so many stories out there now making sounds about how, you know, we're at the end of the oil age. I think it's affecting investors. I think it's making people fearful that there's a long-term future here for oil. You know, but the reality is they are doing quite well. They're performing, especially some of the natural gas companies. I mean, I've invested in a few of the natural gas companies. Some of those guys are up, you know, 15-20% over the last month. And I think people don't realize that a lot of these companies have bounced back somewhat. I'm also, you know, invested in solar. One of my portfolio holdings is Solar Edge, which makes inverters, and they are up 80% for the year. And I think people don't realize that the solar industry has really bounced back after a couple of really bad years. And it was thought that, you know, the election of Trump was going to really hurt the solar sector. And the solar sector has by far outperformed oil stocks. And so I invested in Solar Edge last year, and it declined through the end of the year, and then up 80% this year. In fact, I'm looking right now, it's up 86% year to date, Solar Edge, a maker of solar inverters. You've got some other companies like First Solar that are up. The First Solar's up about 9% today. So, you know, there's always something interesting to invest in the energy sector, and it may not be oil and gas.
Well, it's interesting because there's a lot of perceptions. Number one, oil prices are going to remain low forever. The second perception is the U.S. will be energy independent, which I just don't see in the short term because we're still importing, Robert, 8 to 9 million barrels a day. People forget that. They act like, you know, we don't have imports anymore. And then also eventually, you know, for the car fleet to turn to alternative energy where you and I are driving either being driven in a driverless car or the fact that we all drive electric cars, that's going to take time and probably will not be ubiquitous until we get to the end of the next decade.
Right. And I agree. And in fact, I think Shell CEO came out yesterday and he said we could see peak demand in 10 years. And I would say, okay, I would buy that. That's possible in 10 years. I don't think we'll see peak demand in 10 years, but it's possible. Some of these guys out predicting, you know, by 2020 or 2022, that's not reasonable. We will not see peak demand by then. I mean, we're still this year, the global economy is up, is going to increase demand by 1.4 million barrels or so. That's still happening. And the other thing, if we hit peak demand 10 years from now, and this is something I don't think people really appreciate, it's going to be millions of barrels a day higher than current demand. We're not going to be on this plateau for the next 10 years and then start to decline. We are still rapidly increasing global demand. So that's the counter narrative that I give people when they say, oh, demand is going to peak in 3, 4, 7 years. So, well, it will do so and then a million barrels a day higher per year over that many years. I mean, we're going to need still a lot more oil.
Well, given that, and we're looking for a catalyst, if you were having to place bets right now or probabilities, what would they be? Would you be investing in the energy sector, the energy stocks, natural gas? Do you think we get a catalyst as we head to the fall? In other words, with Aramco's IPO coming next year, do the Saudis finally get around and say, look, the shale producers in the U.S., we underestimated that. The only way we're going to really ramp up prices here is really cut our production. And which is better for the Saudis, to cut production and get the prices up to, let's say, $60 a barrel, or keep doing what they're doing and face $40 a barrel oil and producing more of it?
Yeah, I mean, the only risk they have there if they cut production is, can U.S. shale nullify that production cut? And I don't think they probably can. At least it will take them longer. I think the Saudis could get oil prices up for that IPO. But the catalyst I'd really be keeping an eye on here is Venezuela and the situation there. Because if things fall apart in Venezuela, you know, they still produce about, I think, 3 million barrels a day or something. And that's a significant amount of global production. And if that were to go offline, or if we were to impose sanctions on Venezuelan crude coming into the U.S., I think we'd hit Citgo hard, and Citgo may not have the money to go out and source more crude. So we may see a legitimate shortfall on the market. if that happened, if we put sanctions on them. Now, I don't think we're going to put sanctions on crude from what I've read, but, you know, if they go through plans to rewrite the Constitution down there, I think we'll see potentially a deteriorating situation, and, you know, that could really impact the oil markets.
You know, I don't think investors realize how fragile the oil markets are. And Robert, you bring up an example with Venezuela. And it reminds me last year for a brief moment of time when there was that big fire in the Canadian oil sands and 1 million barrels was taken offline for almost a month in the spike in oil prices. So if Venezuela erupts into full-fledged civil war, as it looks like it's heading in that direction, you can have a couple million barrels taken offline very quickly, and that would be a shock to the oil markets.
Absolutely. And I don't think the market is properly evaluating the risk there of that happening. If that does happen, you will see a sharp move in oil prices. I would predict you'll see a sharp move in oil prices as people come to terms with what has gone off the market.
I am watching that Venezuela thing because, man, you know, the Canadian oil sands took 1 million barrels and prices spiked immediately. Imagine if a couple million barrels were taken off.
Yep. And you know, something that doesn't get much press at all is the amount of production increase in Iran and Iraq over the last year. I think people don't realize just how much production went up there. I mean, production in Iran went up by about 800,000 barrels. And production in Iraq went up by 500,000 barrels. That doesn't get much coverage. You know, Iran production grew 18% last year, and Iraq production grew 11%. And that put a lot of oil on the market. Had that not happened, I think we'd be in a totally different situation. But I don't hear anybody ever talking about that, the surge in production in both those countries.
Absolutely amazing. Well, Robert, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, how could they do so? I know you write for several publications and have a newsletter. Tell our listeners about it.
Yeah, most notably, I write for Investing Daily. I write a couple of free columns that anybody can read, and then I have a subscription service with them called The Energy Strategist. That's Investing Daily. I manage a portfolio. SolarEdge, that I just mentioned, is in our portfolio. It was our top performer for the first 6 months of the year. And then I write a weekly column for Forbes. I've just written a column about Venezuela and how the sanctions on Venezuela may impact U.S. refiners. So Forbes, that's the easiest place to find me, or Investing Daily.
Well, boys and girls, there's the old adage that those who fail to learn from history are condemned to repeat it. But do you know what the first lesson that everybody learns is? Is that the majority of people fail to learn from history. You can actually plan on it. Nowhere could that be more true than when we talk about the manias and bubbles that have plagued markets over the last 500 years. And they go through the same patterns every single time, driven largely by psychology. So today we have a special big picture on the Financial Sense News Hour, the anatomy of a bubble. And there's a reason for this. It's not idle speculation. There's another bubble forming, and we don't want you to get caught by it. All of that coming up next on The Big Picture in the Financial Sense News Hour, as Financial Sense continues at financialsense.com.